to all other types of humanity, these torturers behave mildly and benevolently, like cultivated and humane Europeans, but they are very fond of tormenting children, even fond of children themselves in that sense. It's just their defenselessness that tempts the tormentor, just the angelic confidence of the child who has no refuge and no appeal, that sets his vile blood on fire. In every man, of course, a demon lies hidden, the demon of rage, the demon of lustful heat at the screams of the tortured victim, the demon of lawlessness let off the chain, the demon of diseases that follow on vice, gout, kidney disease, and so on. This poor child of five was subjected to every possible torture by those cultivated parents. They beat her, thrashed her, kicked her for no reason till her body was one bruise. Then, they went to greater refinements of cruelty, shut her up all night in the cold and frost in a privy, and because she didn't ask to be taken up at night, as though a child of five sleeping its angelic, sound sleep could be trained to wake and ask, they smeared her face and filled her mouth with excrement, and it was her mother did this. And that mother could sleep, hearing the poor child's groans. Can you understand why a little creature, who can't even understand what's done to her, should beat her little aching heart with her tiny fist in the dark and the cold, and weep her meek unresentful tears to dear, kind God to protect her? Do you understand that, friend and brother, you pious and humble novice? Do you understand why this infamy must be and is permitted? Without it, I am told, men could not have existed on earth, for he could not have known good and evil. Why should he know that diabolical good and evil when it costs so much? Why, the whole world of knowledge is not worth that child's prayer to dear, kind God. I say nothing of the sufferings of grown-up people, they have eaten the apple, damn them, and the devil take them all. But these little ones. I am making you suffer, Alishaw, you are not yourself. I'll leave off if you like. Never mind. I want to suffer too, muttered Alishaw. One picture, only one more, because it's so curious, so characteristic, and I have only just read it in some collection of Russian antiquities. I've forgotten the name. I must look it up. It was in the darkest days of serfdom at the beginning of the century, and long live the liberator of the people. There was in those days a general of aristocratic connections, the owner of great estates, one of those men, somewhat exceptional, I believe, even then, who, retiring from the service into a life of leisure, are convinced that they've earned absolute power over the lives of their subjects. There were such men then. So our general, settled on his property of 2,000 souls, lives in pomp, and domineers over his poor neighbors as though they were dependents and buffoons. He has kennels of hundreds of hounds and nearly 100 dog boys, all mounted, and in uniform. One day a serf boy, a little child of 8, threw a stone in play and hurt the paw of the general's favorite hound. Why is my favorite dog lame? He is told that the boy threw a stone that hurt the dog's paw. So you did it. The general looked the child up and down. Take him. He was taken, taken from his mother and kept shut up all night. Early that morning the general comes out on horseback, with the hounds, his dependents, dog, boys, and huntsmen, all mounted around him in full hunting parade. The servants are summoned for their edification, and in front of them all stands the mother of the child. The child is brought from the lock, up. It's a gloomy, cold, foggy, autumn day, a capital day for hunting. The general orders the child to be undressed. The child is stripped naked. He shivers, numb with terror, not daring to cry. Make him run, commands the general. Run. Run. Shout the dog, boys. The boy runs. At him. Yells the general, and he sets the whole pack of hounds on the child. The hounds catch him, and tear him to pieces before his mother's eyes. I believe the general was afterwards declared incapable of administering his estates. Well, what did he deserve? To be shot? To be shot for the satisfaction of our moral feelings? Speak, Alishaw. To be shot, murmured Alishaw, lifting his eyes to Ivan with a pale, twisted smile. "Bravo!" cried Ivan delighted. "If even you say so. You're a pretty monk. So there is a little devil sitting in your heart, Alishaw Karamazov. What I said was absurd, but... that's just the point, that but," cried Ivan. "Let me tell you, novice, that the absurd is only too necessary on earth. The world stands on absurdities, and perhaps nothing would have come to pass in it without them. We know what we know. What do you know?" "I understand nothing," Ivan went on, as though in delirium. "I don't want to understand anything now. I want to stick to the fact. I made up my mind long ago not to understand. If I try to understand anything, I shall be false to the fact, and I have determined to stick to the fact." "Why are you trying me?" Alishaw cried, with sudden distress. "Will you say what you mean at last?" "Of course, I will. That's what I've been leading up to. You are dear to me, I don't want to let you go, and I won't give you up to your Zossima." Ivan for a minute was silent, his face became all at once very sad. "Listen. I took the case of children only to make my case clearer. Of the other tears of humanity with which the earth is soaked from its crust to its center, I will say nothing. I have narrowed my subject on purpose. I am a bug, and I recognize in all humility that I cannot understand why the world is arranged as it is. Men are themselves to blame, I suppose. They were given paradise, they wanted freedom, and stole fire from heaven, though they knew they would become unhappy, so there is no need to pity them. With my pitiful, earthly, Euclidean understanding, all I know is that there is suffering and that there are none guilty, that cause follows effect, simply and directly, that everything flows and finds its level, but that's only Euclidean nonsense. I know that, and I can't consent to live by it. What comfort is it to me that there are none guilty and that cause follows effect simply and directly, and that I know it? I must have justice, or I will destroy myself. And not justice in some remote infinite time and space, but here on earth, and that I could see myself. I have believed in it. I want to see it, and if I am dead by then, let me rise again, for if it all happens without me, it will be too unfair. Surely I haven't suffered simply that I, my crimes and my sufferings, may manure the soil of the future harmony for somebody else. I want to see with my own eyes the hind lie down with the lion and the victim rise up and embrace his murderer. I want to be there when everyone suddenly understands what it has all been for. All the religions of the world are built on this longing, and I am a believer. But then there are the children, and what am I to do about them? That's a question I can't answer. For the 100th time I repeat, there are numbers of questions, but I've only taken the children, because in their case what I mean is so unanswerably clear. Listen. If all must suffer to pay for the eternal harmony, what have children to do with it? Tell me, please. It's beyond all comprehension why they should suffer, and why they should pay for the harmony. Why should they, too, furnish material to enrich the soil for the harmony of the future? I understand solidarity in sin among men. I understand solidarity in retribution, too, but there can be no such solidarity with children. And if it is really true that they must share responsibility for all their father's crimes, such a truth is not of this world and is beyond my comprehension. Some jester will say, perhaps, that the child would have grown up and have sinned. But you see, he didn't grow up, he was torn to pieces by the dogs, at 8 years old. Oh, Alishaw, I am not blaspheming. I understand, of course, what an upheaval of the universe it will be when everything in heaven and earth blends in one hymn of praise and everything that lives and has lived cries aloud, "Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed." When the mother embraces the fiend who threw her child to the dogs, and all three cry aloud with tears, "Thou art just, O Lord." Then, of course, the crown of knowledge will be reached and all will be made clear. But what pulls me up here is that I can't accept that harmony. And while I am on earth, I make haste to take my own measures. You see, Alishaw, perhaps it really may happen that if I live to that moment, or rise again to see it, I, too, perhaps, may cry aloud with the rest, looking at the mother embracing the child's torturer, "Thou art just, O Lord." But I don't want to cry aloud then. While there is still time, I hasten to protect myself, and so I renounce the higher harmony altogether. It's not worth the tears of that one tortured child who beat itself on the breast with its little fist and prayed in its stinking outhouse, with its unexpiated tears to dear, kind God. It's not worth it, because those tears are unatoned for. They must be atoned for, or there can be no harmony. But how? How are you going to atone for them? Is it possible? By their being avenged? But what do I care for avenging them? What do I care for a hell for oppressors? What good can hell do, since those children have already been tortured? And what becomes of harmony, if there is hell? I want to forgive. I want to embrace. I don't want more suffering. And if the sufferings of children go to swell the sum of sufferings which was necessary to pay for truth, then I protest that the truth is not worth such a price. I don't want the mother to embrace the oppressor who threw her son to the dogs. She dare not forgive him. Let her forgive him for herself, if she will. Let her forgive the torturer for the immeasurable suffering of her mother's heart. But the sufferings of her tortured child she has no right to forgive. She dare not forgive the torturer, even if the child were to forgive him. And if that is so, if they dare not forgive, what becomes of harmony? Is there in the whole world a being who would have the right to forgive and could forgive? I don't want harmony. From love for humanity I don't want it. I would rather be left with the unavenged suffering. I would rather remain with my unavenged suffering and unsatisfied indignation, even if I were wrong. Besides, too high a price is asked for harmony. It's beyond our means to pay so much to enter on it. And so I hasten to give back my entrance ticket, and if I am an honest man I am bound to give it back as soon as possible. And that I am doing. It's not God that I don't accept, Alishaw, only I most respectfully return him the ticket. That's rebellion, murmured Alishaw, looking down. Rebellion? I am sorry you call it that, said Ivan earnestly. One can hardly live in rebellion, and I want to live. Tell me yourself, I challenge your answer. Imagine that you are creating a fabric of human destiny with the object of making men happy in the end, giving them peace and rest at last, but that it was essential and inevitable to torture to death only one tiny creature, that baby beating its breast with its fist, for instance, and to found that edifice on its unavenged tears. Would you consent to be the architect on those conditions? Tell me, and tell the truth. No, I wouldn't consent, said Alishaw softly. And can you admit the idea that men for whom you are building it would agree to accept their happiness on the foundation of the unexpiated blood of a little victim? And accepting it would remain happy forever? No, I can't admit it. Brother, said Alishaw suddenly, with flashing eyes, you said just now, is there a being in the whole world who would have the right to forgive and could forgive? But there is a being and he can forgive everything, all and for all, because he gave his innocent blood for all and everything. You have forgotten him, and on him is built the edifice, and it is to him they cry aloud, Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed. Ah! The one without sin and his blood. No. I have not forgotten him, on the contrary I've been wondering all the time how it was you did not bring him in before, for usually all arguments on your side put him in the foreground. Do you know, Alishaw? Don't laugh, I made a poem about a year ago. If you can waste another 10 minutes on me, I'll tell it to you. You wrote a poem? Oh, no, I didn't write it, laughed Ivan, and I've never written 2 lines of poetry in my life. But I made up this poem in prose and I remembered it. I was carried away when I made it up. You will be my first reader, that is listener. Why should an author forego even one listener? Smiled Ivan. Shall I tell it to you? I am all attention, said Alishaw. My poem is called The Grand Inquisitor. It's a ridiculous thing, but I want to tell it to you. Chapter 5, The Grand Inquisitor. Even this must have a preface, that is, a literary preface, laughed Ivan, and I am a poor hand at making one. You see, my action takes place in the 16th century, and at that time, as you probably learnt at school, it was customary in poetry to bring down heavenly powers on earth. Not to speak of Dante, in France, clerks, as well as the monks in the monasteries, used to give regular performances in which the Madonna, the saints, the angels, Christ, and God himself were brought on the stage. In those days it was done in all simplicity. In Victor Hugo's Notre Dame, the Paris, an edifying and gratuitous spectacle was provided for the people in the Hôtel de Ville of Paris in the reign of Louis XI in honor of the birth of the Dauphin. It was called Le Bon Jugement de la Treize Sainte et Gracieuse Vierge Marie, and she appears herself on chiefly from the Old Testament, were occasionally performed in Moscow too, up to the times of Peter the Great. But besides plays there were all sorts of legends and ballads scattered about the world, in which the saints and angels and all the powers of heaven took part when required. In our monasteries the monks busied themselves in translating, copying, and even composing such poems, and even under the tatters. There is, for instance, one such poem, of course, from the Greek, The Wanderings of Our Lady Through Hell, with descriptions as bold as Dante's. Our Lady visits hell, and the Archangel Michael leads her through the torments. She sees the sinners and their punishment. There she sees among others one noteworthy set of sinners in a burning lake, some of them sink to the bottom of the lake so that they can't swim out, and these God forgets, an expression of extraordinary depth and force. And so Our Lady, shocked and weeping, falls before the throne of God and begs for mercy for all in hell, for all she has seen there, indiscriminately. Her conversation with God is immensely interesting. She beseeches him, she will not desist, and when God points to the hands and feet of her son, nailed to the cross, and asks, how can I forgive his tormentors? She bids all the saints, all the martyrs, all the angels and archangels to fall down with her and pray for mercy on all without distinction. It ends by her winning from God a respite of suffering every year from Good Friday till Trinity Day, and the sinners at once raise a cry of thankfulness from hell, chanting, Thou art just, O Lord, in this judgment. Well, my poem would have been of that kind if it had appeared at that time. He comes on the scene in my poem, but he says nothing, only appears and passes on. 15 centuries have passed since he promised to come in his glory, 15 centuries since his prophet wrote, Behold, I come quickly, of that day and that hour knoweth no man, neither the Son, but the Father, as he himself predicted on earth. But humanity awaits him with the same faith and with the same love. Oh, with greater faith, for it is 15 centuries since man has ceased to see signs from heaven. No signs from heaven come to day to add to what the heart doth say. There was nothing left but faith in what the heart doth say. It is true there were many miracles in those days. There were saints who performed miraculous cures. Some holy people, according to their biographies, were visited by the Queen of Heaven herself. But the devil did not slumber, and doubts were already arising among men of the truth of these miracles. And just then there appeared in the north of Germany a terrible new heresy. A huge star like to a torch, that is, to a church, fell on the sources of the waters and they became bitter. These heretics began blasphemously denying miracles. But those who remained faithful were all the more ardent in their faith. The tears of humanity rose up to him as before, awaited his coming, loved him, hoped for him, yearned to suffer and die for him as before. And so many ages mankind had prayed with faith and fervor, O Lord our God, hasten thy coming, so many ages called upon him, that in his infinite mercy he deigned to come down to his servants. Before that day he had come down, he had visited some holy men, martyrs, and hermits, as is written in their lives. Among us, Tuchef, with absolute faith in the truth of his words, bore witness that bearing the cross, in slavish dress, weary and worn, The heavenly king our mother, Russia, came to bless, and through our land went wandering. And that certainly was so, I assure you. And behold, he deigned to appear for a moment to the people, to the tortured, suffering people, sunk in iniquity, but loving him like children. My story is laid in Spain, in Seville, in the most terrible time of the Inquisition, when fires were lighted every day to the glory of God, and in the splendid auto da fe the wicked heretics were burned. Oh, of course, this was not the coming in which he will appear, according to his promise, at the end of time in all his heavenly glory, and which will be sudden as lightning flashing from east to west. No, he visited his children only for a moment, and there where the flames were crackling round the heretics. In his infinite mercy he came once more among men in that human shape in which he walked among men for 33 years 15 centuries ago. He came down to the hot pavements of the southern town in which on the day before almost 100 heretics had, ad major em gloriam de, been burnt by the cardinal, the grand inquisitor, in a magnificent auto da fe, in the presence of the king, the court, the knight, the cardinals, the most charming ladies of the court, and the whole population of Seville. He came softly, unobserved, and yet, strange to say, everyone recognized him. That might be one of the best passages in the poem. I mean, why they recognized him. The people are irresistibly drawn to him, they surround him, they flock about him, follow him. He moves silently in their midst with a gentle smile of infinite compassion. The sun of love burns in his heart, and power shine from his eyes, and their radiance, shed on the people, stirs their hearts with responsive love. He holds out his hands to them, blesses them, and a healing virtue comes from contact with him, even with his garments. An old man in the crowd, blind from childhood, cries out, "O Lord, heal me and I shall see thee." And, as it were, scales fall from his eyes and the blind man sees him. The crowd weeps and kisses the earth under his feet. Children throw flowers before him, sing, and cry Hosanna. It is he, it is he. Repeat. It must be he, it can be no one but him. He stops at the steps of the Seville Cathedral at the moment when the weeping mourners are bringing in a little open white coffin. In it lies a child of 7, the only daughter of a prominent citizen. The dead child lies hidden in flowers. "He will raise your child," the crowd shouts to the weeping mother. The priest, coming to meet the coffin, looks perplexed, and frowns, but the mother of the dead child throws herself at his feet with a wail. "If it is thou, raise my child," she cries, holding out her hands to him. The procession halts, the coffin is laid on the steps at his feet. He looks with compassion, and his lips once more softly pronounce, "Maiden, arise." And the maiden arises. The little girl sits up in the coffin and looks round, smiling with wide, open wondering eyes, holding a bunch of white roses they had put in her hand. There are cries, sobs, confusion among the people, and at that moment the cardinal himself, the grand inquisitor, passes by the cathedral. He is an old man, almost 90, tall and erect, with a withered face and sunken eyes, in which there is still a gleam of light. He is not dressed in his gorgeous cardinal's robes, as he was the day before, when he was burning the enemies of the Roman Church. At this moment he is wearing his coarse, old, monk's cassock. At a distance behind him come his gloomy assistants and slaves and the holy guard. He stops at the sight of the crowd and watches it from a distance. He sees everything. He sees them set the coffin down at his feet, sees the child rise up, and his face darkens. He knits his thick grey brows and his eyes gleam with a sinister fire. He holds out his finger and bids the guards take him. And such is his power, so completely are the people cowed into submission and trembling obedience to him, that the crowd immediately makes way for the guards, and in the midst of death-like silence they lay hands on him and lead him away. The crowd instantly bows down to the earth, like one man, before the old inquisitor. He blesses the people in silence and passes on. The guards lead their prisoner to the close, gloomy vaulted prison, in the ancient palace of the Holy Inquisition and shut him in it. The day passes and is followed by the dark, burning, breathless night of Seville. The air is fragrant with laurel and lemon. In the pitch darkness the iron door of the prison is suddenly opened and the Grand Inquisitor himself comes in with a light in his hand. He is alone, the door is closed at once behind him. He stands in the doorway and for a minute or two gazes into his face. At last he goes up slowly, sets the light on the table and speaks. Is it thou? Thou? But receiving no answer, he adds at once. Don't answer, be silent. What canst thou say, indeed? I know too well what thou wouldst say. And thou hast no right to add anything to what thou hadst said of old. Why, then, art thou come to hinder us? For thou hast come to hinder us, and thou knowest that. But dost thou know what will be to-morrow? I know not who thou art and care not to know whether it is thou or only a semblance of him, but to-morrow I shall condemn thee and burn thee at the stake as the worst of heretics. And the very people who have to-day kissed thy feet, tomorrow at the faintest sign from me will rush to heap up the embers of thy fire. Knowest thou that? Yes, maybe thou knowest it, he added with thoughtful penetration, never for a moment taking his eyes off the prisoner. I don't quite understand, Ivan. What does it mean? Alishaw, who had been listening in silence, said with a smile. Is it simply a wild fantasy, or a mistake on the part of the old man, some impossible quid pro quo? Take it as the last, said Ivan, laughing, if you are so corrupted by modern realism and can't stand anything fantastic. If you like it to be a case of mistaken identity, let it be so. It is true, he went on, laughing, the old man was 90, and he might well be crazy over his set idea. He might have been struck by the appearance of the prisoner. It might, in fact, be simply his ravings, the delusion of an old man of 90, over, excited by the auto da fe of 100 heretics the day before. But does it matter to us after all whether it was a mistake of identity or a wild fantasy? All that matters is that the old man should speak out, that he should speak openly of what he has thought in silence for 90 years. And the prisoner too is silent? Does he look at him and not say a word? That's inevitable in any case, Ivan laughed again. The old man has told him he hasn't the right to add anything to what he has said of old. One may say it is the most fundamental feature of Roman Catholicism, in my opinion at least. All has been given by thee to the Pope, they say, and all, therefore, is still in the Pope's hands, and there is no need for thee to come now at all. Thou must not meddle for the time, at least. That's how they speak and write to the Jesuits, at any rate. I have read it myself in the works of their theologians. Hast thou the right to reveal to us one of the mysteries of that world from which thou hast come? My old man asks him, and answers the question for him. No, thou hast not, but thou mayst not add to what has been said of old, and mayst not take from men the freedom which thou didst exalt when thou wast on earth. Whatsoever thou revealest anew will encroach on men's freedom of faith, for it will be manifest as a miracle, and the freedom of their faith was dearer to thee than anything in those days 1500 years ago. Didst thou not often say then, I will make you free? But now thou hast seen these free men, the old man adds suddenly, with a pensive smile. Yes, we've paid dearly for it, he goes on, looking sternly at him. But at last we have completed that work in thy name. For 15 centuries we have been wrestling with thy freedom, but now it is ended and over for good. Dost thou not believe that it's over for good? Thou lookest meekly at me and deignest not even to be wroth with me. But let me tell thee that now, today, people are more persuaded than ever that they have perfect freedom, yet they have brought their freedom to us and laid it humbly at our feet. But that has been our doing. Was this what thou didst? Was this thy freedom? I don't understand again. Alishaw broke in. Is he ironical? Is he jesting? Not a bit of it. He claims it as a merit for himself and his church that at last they have vanquished freedom and have done so to make men happy. For now, he is speaking of the Inquisition. Of course, for the first time it has become possible to think of the happiness of men. Man was created a rebel, and how can rebels be happy? Thou wast warned, he says to him.